next case on our calendar is 97-2149. Early Manahar versus Massam Community Hospital. Mr. Van Bark.
Good morning. I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Rebuttal. May I please report? There are three primary ways to resolve pending case structure for the court. One is dismissal on grounds of legal merits. Second is court order of judgment or rule on merits, which is issued by a court of competent jurisdiction on the result of which should not be seen. The third means is settlement based on the parties, which is in fact contract law. It can be enforced by the courts to enforce the contract between the parties. If a court renders judgment but lacks subject matter jurisdiction, or does not have competent jurisdiction, this was a rule in Bradley v. Parkman and State Ex Rel. Court Department. This was well briefed in both parties' briefs, so I will only touch briefly on that. Our position, the appellant's position in this case, is that the case of International Philanthropic Foundation Hospital's correct decision on the issue in this case, that the only effect of a dismissal with prejudice in court that lacks subject matter jurisdiction is to bar relitigation of the issue of subject matter jurisdiction within the court.
When you say your whole position hinges on this being a lack of jurisdiction, could this case not have been dismissed by the district court under 12b-6, failure to state a claim? Wouldn't be jurisdictional, would it?
I believe it would, but I think the ground would have to be in this case that there is no jurisdiction for failure to state a claim. That it would be looked at from the standpoint that the complaint in this action failed to set forth reasonable grounds for jurisdiction.
We dismiss on 12b-6 all the time. We don't treat that as jurisdictional, do we, counsel?
It is my understanding that you can treat the effect of pleading as failure to state a claim for grounds such as failure to state jurisdiction or failure to state statute of limitations. Pleading is clearly deficient in that aspect.
Or for failure to assert a necessary element. In this case, the element was that no state action.
Yes, that is jurisdictional, to my understanding. Under 28 U.S.C. 1343, that the state action would have to be jurisdictional. I mean, you would have to show state action to have jurisdiction in this court.
Is there a difference between the parties having filed that action without prejudice versus with prejudice? And I guess I'll jump to my second question. If you show jurisdiction and both parties agree they can do it without prejudice, on the other hand, it sounds to me like there's consideration here for the with prejudice. You dismiss it with prejudice and you won't grant you for Rule 11 sanctions for filing a civil claim in federal court. It doesn't mean that there's a given estate, and that supports the with prejudice, which gives rise to the reason why she didn't raise it.
So, as your first question, is there a difference between the dismissal without prejudice and the dismissal with prejudice? Yes, there is. Back by the case law cited by defendants in this case. Dismissal without prejudice at this point in time would probably have required court approval in the case. Dismissal without prejudice, I mean with prejudice, did not require a stipulation in this case. As noted in the case of Sue versus Fox, 6th District Court opinion here. And therefore, the stipulation in and of itself would not constitute an agreement because there was no requirement that there would be a stipulation by the defendant in the case of dismissal.
Didn't the stipulation imply agreement?
It implies an agreement in the sense that, in this case, what you were talking about, the extra consideration, we will not file Rule 11 sanctions in this case, but it would be extrinsic to the actual document, which was the stipulated dismissal. In that case, we'd have to take a look at what the contract was in this case. First of all, there was a contract supposedly between counsel that did not involve the Early Manahar, who was the actual party of interest in this case. According to this case, the court's decision in Moore versus Crouch, you cannot have a settlement by an attorney who does not have actual authority to settle the case. There's no apparent authority to settle be clients of claims to case.
Is there evidence in record that clients do not know this dismissal without proof, without mention of it?
Well, your proof on this case was on the defendant group, because they were raising this argument that this was enforceable contract. So burden of proof is on the defendant of the claim to see if it's enforceable contract. Well, our evidence was that it was not signed by our client in this case. Again, stipulated dismissal, there's no required commitment for stipulation for dismissal with prejudice in the case. But yet, that we could have dismissed the case with prejudice without any stipulation by the opposing counsel. So therefore, the document itself is not a contract on space. We have to look at the extrinsic evidence in the case to see what the terms of the agreement was. Not to a settlement or disposition of the case on the final disposition. That was one of the things I was going to raise in this argument, is that the defense counsel has said to the fact that negligence of counsel can be attributed to the plaintiff in the case. That's a different scenario than an extrajudicial settlement between the counsel. You have a situation where the plaintiff chooses counsel in a case, and if the counsel misses the statute of limitations, that's negligence which should be imposed upon the plaintiff. When you have, through the court system, not through other counsel, but when you have a contract between the parties, opposing counsel enters at his own risk a contract with counsel from the other party without any signature from the client. There's no apparent authority to settle this whole case. Another issue that I want to bring up was that there was no evidentiary hearing regarding the contract in the lower court. This court noted in Woolley versus Fan Company where there's a legitimate dispute regarding the enforceability of a settlement contract between the parties. There should be an evidentiary hearing. For this reason alone, the case is appropriate for remand to decide whether there's an enforceable contract between the parties.
What reason were the sanctions given? Were they given because plaintiff's lawyer should have known better than filing this in the federal court?
Yes, exactly. That there were no grounds for jurisdiction in the case. It's my understanding why the motion for sanctions was not actually filed, my understanding, but it was proper to the
threat. So there weren't any sanctions really issued?
No.
And that's why the journal entry got put in with prejudice?
Yes.
Would there have been a ground for sanctions on the basis that you filed in wrong court?
I believe there could have been grounds for sanctions on the issue if there had been a lack of investigation on the part of the counsel prior to filing a complaint as to the state involvement of the agency. So there was no good faith grounds for claiming that, that the hospital was not affiliated with the state. I believe, yes, there could have been sanctions. That was an issue that was never reached by the court.
Thank goodness.
Why should we not? There are several cases, as you know, that say that whether it's a dismissal
sanctions are filed
with prejudice, that's a dismissal on the, that's adjudication of merits. Why should we not follow that law?
Well, I believe all those cases are situations where there was no real dispute about the jurisdiction for most of those decisions. The reason why it should be come out this way is because res judicata is a public policy. It's a public policy argument for res judicata to eliminate cases which been stopped by continuous litigation of cases when there's been a final decision on the merits of the case. It has to be weighed against the constitutionality of the court usurping its power and trying to assume jurisdiction in a case where it has no jurisdiction. Now, it may be a benevolent extension of that power, but the constitutionality of such usurpation should not be allowed.
Putting it plainly, if a court is without subject matter jurisdiction, how in the world would it be able to decide a case on the merits?
That's exactly my point. If it lacks subject matter jurisdiction, they cannot decide on the merits. I don't know.
Mr. Reichel.
May it please the court, with all the heavy hitters behind me coming up for the next case that's on the court's docket, I feel a little bit like a warm-up after a Frank Sinatra concert. But I will attempt to put my act on as briefly as possible so you can get to the next case. I think this is an example of a case where lawyers make something simple confusing. The law in the state of Ohio for years, I think, has been clear that the judgment entry of dismissal with prejudice ends the lawsuit between the parties. The law also says that it not only ends the lawsuit as to those issues raised in the lawsuit, but also all other issues that were known and could have been raised. And that is the law of Ohio. Now, parties can settle their disputes before filing the lawsuit or after filing the lawsuit. And the law encourages parties to settle their disputes. That's why when a lawsuit is filed, jurors are not allowed to be told what negotiations the parties have had to settle their lawsuit.
So you would say that if somebody filed in a municipal court an action on a note for $25,000, and the court looks at it on its face and says the jurisdiction of the municipal court is $15,000, we don't have jurisdiction over this case. The attorneys agree and they say, okay, let's dismiss that with prejudice. That ends the case from going across the street to the common pleas court.
Well, first of all, the attorney would not dismiss that with prejudice because he would know that the case could be refiled, and he would not dismiss it with prejudice. He would dismiss it without prejudice. In this case, we don't get into whether or not the court had jurisdiction because the two parties who were parties to the lawsuit entered into an agreement to dismiss the lawsuit with prejudice.
And if you look at the evidence, that ends it whenever we never look at anything else, as long as the case is dismissed with prejudice, that's on the merits, it's over.
You never get to the issue of jurisdiction, and if you look at the affidavit of Attorney Peters that was filed at the Court of Appeals, under federal rules, there are different Ohio rules. For a motion for sanctions under Rule 11, you don't just file that with the court. You have to serve that on the other party, and then you have to wait so many days before you're allowed to file that with the court. So in this case, we have a frivolous lawsuit. The appellee put the appellate on notice. Look, you have a frivolous lawsuit, and here is our motion for sanctions, and we're going to ask for monetary recuperation. And therefore, Dr. Manohar and his attorneys were worried under Rule 11 that they have financial exposure for filing a frivolous lawsuit. So they negotiated. They said, well, we'll file the lawsuit without prejudice. Massive Community Hospital's attorneys said, oh, no. No, no, you aren't going to file this without prejudice. You're going to dismiss it with prejudice, and then we will not pursue the Rule 11 motions for sanctions. I don't know what else you need to have a contract.
All of that's in the record.
Yes.
We know all of that to be true.
That is all in the record. So therefore, the only case they have asking you to reverse this is the California case in the Court of Claims. And if you read that case, it seemed like there was a turf battle between the federal court and the Court of Claims. The Court of Claims got mad because when the federal court dismissed that action, it did not advise the parties, hey guys, you can go to the Court of Claims. Evidently, the Court of Claims out there didn't have much work. Bad law in the California Court of Claims should not be a reason for bad law in the state of Ohio. And also, if you think for a moment, if you would reverse this case, it means that when two parties dismiss a case, stipulation, dismissal, with prejudice, they would first have to go to the court and say, We have to have a hearing on whether or not you have jurisdiction, and you have to make a finding on that you have jurisdiction. Because if you would not ask the court to do that, if you reverse this, the stipulation of dismissal with prejudice means nothing. And then, years later, they could come back and reopen the case, and then we'd be in a situation where our civil law would be like our capital murder cases, where there is no end to it.
So, if you take that position, Judge Gwynn's dissent in the Court of Appeals just totally missed the mark.
He and I are very good friends. Yes, he did.
Should we draw a distinction between dismissal in a federal court where a federal court has no jurisdiction, but there may be jurisdiction in state court, and limit the with prejudice to refiling in the federal court? Isn't that that sort of an underlying issue here, I guess? Is that?
Well, but there are a whole string of cases that said that dismissal of a matter in federal court dismisses all the state claims also. So the appellee would allege that rather than create havoc in Ohio law, this court would affirm this case and maintain the law that has been the law of Ohio for years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reichel. Mr. Van Bargen, you saved 5 minutes of time.
To answer Justice Brennan's earlier question regarding consideration as well, sanctions, in my opinion, may have been imposed against the attorneys in the case, but they could not be imposed against Merle Manohar according to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 11. That demonstrates the situation that there was no consideration of Merle Manohar for his release of his right to bring a suit against the entire agreement.
Does the federal rule say that he's not assessing sanctions in
the line? I believe for a legal judgment in filing a pleading, that the sanctions cannot be imposed against the client for the decision of the attorney to make that legal judgment. So that therefore...
Is that
a lie? I believe the rule is different.
Well, Mr. Reichel seems to indicate that we'll find in the record that there was this agreement, that that's why it was dismissed with prejudice rather than without prejudice. That, are you contesting that?
Agreement between counsel. And there was no evidence in the record that there was agreement between William Manohar and the opposing counsel, or the defendants in the case.
Well, there'd be some reason that counsel did not insist on dismissing without prejudice to protect his client, wouldn't there? There would have to be some reason to give away that right.
Mm-hmm. Running against sanctions is a possibility. I don't want to...
Go against sanctions against the lawyer, but we don't worry about the client, I guess.
And I don't want to...
Okay. No, I don't want to...
But the client may have a claim here, and that... In fact, we have a case, I think the name is Brown, where it involved a former justice, where we said that, you know, the opposite of what you're saying. We say the lawyer is responsible, and the client's responsible for choosing a lawyer who acted either outside his interest or incompetently. In this whole case, we have to presume that a lawyer is acting competently and in the interest of his client. If that didn't happen here, we know what happens. Client looks to the lawyer, right?
I would assume that in this case, though, that we have a situation where there is negligence on the part of the attorney, that it was not a negotiated settlement in the parties. In the case of negligence on the part of the plaintiff's attorney, the defendant should not have to bear the consequences of the plaintiff's counsel's negligence. But in this case, the defendant entered a settlement with the plaintiff's counsel without asserting whether he had authority to enter that settlement. Judge Gordon versus Couches, there's no inherent authority to settle the case by the private attorney. It's an express authority.
Yes, I have jurisdiction.
That's...
It doesn't have to be in writing.
Sorry?
Express authority between the client and his lawyer?
It does not have to be in writing.
Right, but it says between the client and his lawyer,
yes.
Not as it relates to parties depending on it. The third party.
That might be a question of estoppel in that case, but again, it's a question of fact, I think, whether it was reasonable in this situation, because the only consideration was being offered to the counsel, not to Dr. Manohar. So therefore, they should have known that this was not a settlement that was beneficial to my client.
attorney on the side has said, hey, we want to depose your client, make sure he agrees that this is a practice before we agree.
Well, they could have done it.
Do they have a right to rely on the attorney? Do you want to do it?
They could have asked for the signature on settlement. And that's one of the things that opposing counsel brought up, that this is going to turn dismissal of prejudice on its head. Not that there's a valid settlement agreement prepared beforehand, which actually puts into effect the right of dismissal of prejudice.
How do we know on this record that the client is...
Yes, yes, and I agree with that, but the burden of proof is on the side of the show.
Not part of the record, but we can't decide it on the record, it's a pure speculation.
They are arguing the affirmative of a contract existing, which is not even pertinent to that venture agreement report.
You not disagree with that contract according to the record?
Well, I have respect for this.
Do you have any other clients in the reading records?
No, I do not.
Then you have to disagree with the contract.
I would, again, respect to disagree, I think the permanent burden is on the defendant.
And counsel, would the better rule for the good of all be that when lawyers involved in litigation representing to each other would struck a bargain here, and to then reduce that to writing form of a journal entry which is signed by the lawyers, would the better rule be if, for some reason, one client, one party, wasn't agreeing, that party sued their lawyer rather than that the party on the other side of the case has made this to suffer?
But I think in this case, the burden should be on the party who is trying to achieve a dismissal with prejudice by consulting the lawyer rather than the client on the other side, on the grounds that it's easy to get the signature of Dr. Vanhart in this case.
It's easy for the hospital to get his signature.
If poor counsel in this case actually wanted to dismiss with prejudice, they could have obtained Dr. Vanhart's signature on the stipulated dismissal case.
There's no real law in the part.
Well, there should have been at least an underlying contract between the parties.
Why should the opposing party have to chase the other lawyer's client down to make sure that they're in agreement?
Because
we can't rely on... Not every case is settled at the courthouse at the counsel table. Hopefully, a lot of things are settled over the telephone with documents that we follow up to subject those to the courthouse. Ordinarily, the client doesn't sign anything in terms of the documents that the court filed. The client doesn't sign the complaint.
Yes. I think that it's public policy debate. What is the easier solution, I guess, to obtain the agreement of the clients in the case of a breach settlement? It's no different than having a settlement of final merits where there's money exchanged in lieu of filing or pursuing the case. It's no different. There's always a signature of pain in those situations. Versus having the client sue his attorney in a medical legal malpractice case through the court system and bringing an extra lawsuit on top of what we already have.
I guess the difficulty I'm having with your argument is that since we're being asked to write an exception to the well-established rule in Ohio, established rule in the country to sort of protect a lawyer here who it seems at best maybe didn't use good judgment. Is that
I think it's
a fair observation?
My argument is consistent with Moore versus Couch that settlement of disposition of the case in the past has the client's approval, express approval on the case. And she can't accept the attorney's representation that they have at the court.
Yeah, you can.
It's more proper to have actual confirmation.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised for our opinion.